Okay, let's unpack this. In the world of high-tech finance, you know, rumors fly fast. They're cheap. But when a rumor involves, well, a potential massive financial lifeline, maybe extended by a giant like Apple to its struggling former partner, Intel, yeah, then we have to treat it as maybe something more than just market chatter. We're talking about these whispers, these suggestions that the semiconductor behemoth, Intel, might have actually approached Apple. Apple sitting on arguably one of the largest corporate cash piles in history, mind you. And the approach was about a potential strategic investment.
It's an astounding piece of speculation, really, because if you think about it, it represents a complete, well, a 180-degree reversal of fortune. Historically, Apple was the one dependent on Intel, right?
Yeah.
Their customer. Now, suddenly, Intel is potentially the one asking for help, the supplicant. This kind of pairing, these two titans, I mean, it could signal a seismic shift, theoretically, if it were true. But our mission today, for you, is really to move past the gossip, the headlines, and scrutinize this thing deeply. We need to go straight to those core questions that the analysis brings up. Why would Intel even reach out? Is that plausible? And maybe more importantly, does a move like this make any strategic sense for Apple? Does it align with their, frankly, fiercely disciplined strategic and financial goals?
Right. That is our mission for you, the listener, today. We are digging into this interaction, scrutinizing it through the, let's say, uncompromising lens of corporate strategy, capital allocation, and advanced innovation. By the time we're done with this deep dive, you should have a complete shortcut to being fully informed. Informed on the current and, frankly, deeply divergent positions of both Intel and Apple. And also, what this whole scenario, this rumor reveals about the true power dynamics shaping the modern semiconductor industry today. It's fascinating. And to get there, I think we absolutely must start with the history. You have to understand the backstory, because the relationship between these two companies, well, it basically defined the last era of personal computing.
Exactly. You can't appreciate the sheer strategic gravity of Intel's alleged outreach without remembering the era of their undisputed dominance. I mean, for decades, they weren't just a chip supplier. They were the essential engine, the heart of personal computing.
Oh, yeah, that iconic Intel Inside slogan. Everyone remembers that. And it wasn't just like a slick advertising campaign, was it? It was genuinely the foundation of the desktop and laptop revolution. Their proprietary x86 architecture, that was the standard. Full stop. If you bought a computer between, say, the mid-90s and maybe, what, 2015, the odds were just astronomical that Intel was inside, supplying that fundamental processing power. They truly commanded the digital age for a long, long time.
They absolutely did. But, well, technological progress doesn't stand still, does it? Especially in mobile computing. And that progress began to expose some structural weaknesses in Intel's model, particularly from Apple's perspective. Apple's internal analysis, you see, started revealing the inherent limitations that came from those external dependencies. It became a bottleneck. When your product's performance, its power consumption, its thermal envelope are all constrained by a vendor's public roadmap, well, you lose control. You lose control over crucial elements of your own product design. And Apple, you know, they were constantly having to design their thin, sleek MacBooks and even the iPhones before the A series got really mature around the heat and power limits imposed by Intel's chips. It was a constraint.
Right. So their answer to that limitation wasn't just, okay, let's find a new supplier. It was way more radical than that. It was this massive internal strategic pivot to basically take over the entire design chain themselves.
Vertical integration, right.
Right.
Precisely. And it wasn't an overnight thing. It was a methodical, multi-year journey into custom silicon design. Really quite impressive when you look back. It started subtly, almost quietly, with the A-series chips for iPhones and iPads. And those chips gave them really unprecedented control over mobile performance and, crucially, efficiency. Power efficiency became key. But the true culmination of this whole effort, the really revolutionary transition we're digging into now, was that wholesale migration, moving the entire Mac lineup, everything, over to their own proprietary M-series processors, which, importantly, were based on the ARM architecture, not x86.
And the analysis of why they made that shift is so critical here. It wasn't just swapping out one component for another. It was, as you said, a fundamental redefinition of the entire computing stack. And it seemed driven by this relentless focus on performance per watt. Efficiency.
That's absolutely the key metric, performance per watt. The transition, you know, it was really catalyzed by Intel's difficulties, specifically their notorious struggle with moving to the next generation process nodes. Remember the whole 10 nanometer saga, which they later sort of awkwardly rebranded as Intel 7. But those delays, they severely constrained the performance gains and, just as importantly, the power efficiency improvements in the chips Apple was getting. Meanwhile, Apple's internal teams, they could see the writing on the wall. They recognized the exponential gains that were possible using their own custom ARM designs manufactured by someone else like TSMC.
That's a huge distinction, isn't it? It wasn't just, oh, we're unhappy with Intel. It was a realization, backed by their own A-series success, that Apple itself could design a superior chip, a chip that Intel at that time simply couldn't supply on schedule or within the power envelope Apple needed for its product vision.
Correct. It was about capability. Apple saw they could do better themselves, or at least direct the design better. So that strategic pivot, it secured Apple total control, and it led directly to products like, you know, the modern MacBook Air, the Mac Studio. These machines deliver phenomenal processing power, often without even needing a fan, without the heat issues that older Intel-based Macs generated, and this fundamentally altered the dynamics between the two companies completely. For Intel, losing the entire Mac contract wasn't just a dent in their revenue, though it was significant. It was also a devastating psychological blow, I think, and an operational one, too. It signaled very publicly that even their most critical high-profile partners could, and indeed would, walk away if Intel's own process technology lagged behind.
So, okay, let's fast forward now from that breakup to today, and we face this really remarkable, almost unbelievable strategic juxtaposition. It's quite the turnaround. You have Intel, the former undisputed king, now facing, well, let's call it operational turbulence, and according to these rumors, maybe seeking capital. And then you have Apple, the ascendant power. The company that actively decided it didn't need Intel's products anymore. The one that walked away.
That is the absolute core of the strategic misfit we're analyzing here. It's a fascinating contrast. Intel right now is wrestling with some considerable manufacturing challenges. That's no secret. They face intense competition, not just from their traditional rival AMD in the CPU market, which has really eaten into their market share, but perhaps more existentially, they're competing now with manufacturing powerhouses like TSMC in Taiwan and Samsung. These companies specialize only in foundry services making chips for others, and they've become incredibly good at it. Intel has, frankly, been outmaneuvered in several key technological advancements, particularly around those advanced process nodes, the cutting-edge stuff.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Apple isn't just, you know, sitting on a pile of money counting it. They've absolutely solidified their position as a design leader, a consumer electronics powerhouse. And they are increasingly dominating in that sophisticated realm of advanced chip design.
Yeah.
You could argue they're setting the pace for the entire industry with their M-series chips.
The contrast is incredibly stark. So this reported outreach from Intel, if it happened, where there isn't any immediately apparent, direct, or obvious reciprocal benefit for Apple, I mean, it naturally forces us to scrutinize, okay, what could the nature of this potential investment actually be? What form might it take?
Right. Let's just immediately rule out the simplest, maybe the most obvious answer, which, as you often say, is frequently the wrong one in these complex situations. Mm-hmm. This is not about Apple suddenly deciding, oops, we made a mistake. We need Intel's current generation CPUs for our Macs or iPhones again.
Mm-hmm.
That specific product chapter, as all the analysis confirms, that book is closed, tightly shut. So if it's not for buying their current chips, what could this rumored investment possibly look like?
Okay, so we have to systematically walk through the possibilities and, well, probably reject most of them based on Apple's known behavior. Possibility one, a general equity stake. Apple just buys a chunk of Intel stock, essentially a passive investment of potentially billions of dollars, buying shares on the open market maybe, to help stabilize Intel's balance sheet or fund its turnaround.
Okay, but why would Apple reject that? I mean, Intel is trying to execute this massive turnaround under CEO Pat Gelsinger, the IDM 2.0 strategy. If that works, even partially, the stock could rebound significantly, couldn't it? Isn't there an upside?
There's a potential upside, sure, but it's a classic speculative investment. And that kind of move is just, well, it's antithetical to Apple's financial DNA. It's not how they operate. Apple is incredibly focused, laser focused, you might say. They do not typically invest vast sums of capital in struggling entities outside of their core ecosystem just for a potential general equity game. It's too messy, too indirect. Their investments almost universally must either fuel their own immediate growth engines, their products, their services, or efficiently return capital to their shareholders. Those are the priorities. Taking a passive stake in a highly volatile turnaround story like Intel's, that's far too risky and, crucially, non-synergistic for Apple's model. They invest to control outcomes related to their ecosystem, not merely to place a bet on someone else's recovery.
Okay, that makes sense. So passive equity stakes, probably off the table. What about the idea of a more active partnership, maybe a strategic collaboration on specific next generation technology, something that might secure Apple a place in future Intel factories, perhaps for specific niche components?
Well, that sounds slightly more plausible on paper, maybe. a strategic partnership. But you have to remember, Apple already maintains these deep, highly optimized, long-standing manufacturing relationships with the current industry leader, TSMC. And the core difference here is the fundamental business model. It's structural. TSMC operates as a pure-play foundry. Their entire business is making chips for others. Apple, AMD, NVIDIA, Qualcomm, dozens of major clients. And this model allows them to spread their massive research and development costs, particularly for incredibly expensive next-generation lithography like extreme ultraviolet, EUV. They spread those costs across their entire huge client base, which makes them incredibly efficient at pushing the technology forward.
Right. So because TSMC is just focused on manufacturing for everyone, they can push those process nodes faster, more reliably, and probably more cost-effectively than Intel, which has historically tried to do everything in-house.
Exactly. Intel operates under the Integrated Device Manufacturer, or IDM, model. They design the chips, and historically, they manufactured them almost exclusively internally in their own fabs. This created, over time, internal bottlenecks and less flexibility, especially when their own manufacturing process technology started to lag behind the pure-play foundries. So for Apple to partner significantly with Intel on manufacturing now, Intel's future manufacturing capabilities under their new Intel Foundry Services, or IFS, banner would have to promise something dramatically superior or perhaps strategically necessary compared to what TSMC is already delivering reliably. And currently, today, that clear competitive advantage for IFS over TSMC just doesn't exist. They're still building it.
Okay. But this raises a critical question, though, and it's one I think listeners might really latch onto: geopolitics. Even with TSMC's current technical superiority, wouldn't a minority investment in Intel, maybe specifically tied to their U.S. or European fab buildouts, couldn't that potentially secure future U.S.-based manufacturing capacity for Apple, especially if the geopolitical landscape, say, between the U.S. and Taiwan gets more complicated? Isn't there a kind of supply chain insurance policy benefit here that Apple should seriously consider, given how reliant they are on overseas fabs, primarily TSMC in Taiwan?
That is, I think, the only potentially non-financial, purely strategic reason one could logically construct for Apple getting involved financially with Intel right now. It moves the whole discussion away from what's best for Apple's immediate bottom line towards what's prudent for long-term supply chain resilience and de-risking.
Yeah.
However, most analysts looking at this would likely argue that if Apple truly wanted to secure a dedicated U.S. capacity, the logical move wouldn't be a general equity investment in the broader, still struggling Intel IDM business. That's too indirect. Instead, they'd likely pursue a joint venture or perhaps a specific, very large, long-term purchasing agreement directly with Intel's Foundry Services arm, IFS. They might even co-invest in a specific fab line dedicated to Apple's needs. That gives them control and certainty, unlike just buying stock.
Okay, that distinction is much clearer. Investing in the whole company versus directly funding or contracting for a specific capacity are very different things. So if it's likely not a general equity stake and probably not a broad manufacturing partnership, that leaves the third, maybe more targeted scenario. Could the investment rumor actually be a veiled hint at Apple acquiring a particular Intel division? Maybe a focused grab for specific talent or some niche technology?
That is the only approach, really, that aligns even remotely with Apple's historical M&A strategy, their track record for acquisitions, which, as you know, are often termed acqui-hires. They typically buy smaller, innovative firms, often for tens or hundreds of millions, maybe a billion at most, and they do it for specific talent pools or a particular piece of intellectual property they need. Think modems, camera tech, AI startups. They might conceivably be interested in a highly specific area where Intel has made strides, perhaps related to advanced packaging, or maybe even aspects of connectivity or wireless technology, an area where Intel did acquire modem tech previously. But again, the public rumor, as floated, was about a broad investment, implying something larger scale, maybe billions. Apple prefers to acquire small, nimble teams and integrate them quickly and quietly into their own structure. They generally don't take minority stakes in large, complex divisions that are still deeply tied to a larger company's complex turnaround strategy. It's just not their style.
Right. And I think the analyst perspective you mentioned earlier is the most revealing lens here. For any major capital deployment by Apple, we're talking billions. The primary question for Apple shareholders, for the board, is always crystal clear, isn't it? It's
right.
What is the obvious, compelling, direct benefit for Apple? For us, the investing party.
Precisely. And when you apply that filter to this rumored Intel investment, that list of obvious, compelling benefits, it remains conspicuously short. almost non-existent, some would argue. Apple's incredible success, its entire ecosystem's advantage, stems directly from that vertical integration and its custom silicon, the A series, the M series. They spent years and untold billions to specifically ensure they never again needed to compromise their product vision, their performance, or their power efficiency by relying on an external chip vendor's roadmap, especially one that was lagging. So investing significantly in Intel now, it risks undermining that very control they fought so hard to achieve. It feels backward-looking. Apple is focused on designing the world's best, most efficient chips for their specific needs. They are not fundamentally interested in subsidizing the complex, expensive restructuring of traditional by 86 manufacturing at a competitor.
Yeah, an investment here really does feel like a strategic detour, doesn't it? Rather than an acceleration of their current incredibly successful path.
It absolutely does, which forces us, logically, to pivot narrow fully to the financial side of things, because this is where the mismatch becomes. While glaringly evident, we are talking about potentially committing tens of billions of dollars, a huge sum, even for Apple, to a legacy semiconductor company, a company, Intel, that is navigating immense operational volatility and intense competitive pressure on multiple fronts.
Well, what does that kind of commitment actually mean in terms of capital allocation risk for a company like Apple?
Yeah.
I mean, they've historically been so incredibly rigid, so disciplined about their financial strategy. How does this fit?
Well, it doesn't, really. It introduces considerable diversification risk, which is a key concept for investors here. For a company of Apple's scale, generating profits measured in the hundreds of billions annually, capital is still technically a finite resource. And it absolutely must be deployed for maximum strategic effect, aligned with their core objectives. Their capital, logically, should fuel their own highly profitable innovation pipelines and growth engines, the next iPhone, the next Mac chip, Vision Pro, their services. Investing significantly in Intel means diluting that capital. It means diverting funds to support an external entity facing major challenges in a volatile market segment. And not just any market segment, but the very one high-performance CPUs for PCs that Apple strategically exited because Intel couldn't meet their needs. It's almost paradoxical.
Right. And we probably need to elaborate a bit more on the specific hurdles Intel is facing right now. These aren't trivial issues. These translate directly into financial volatility and risk for any potential investor.
Yeah.
You mentioned the 10 nanometer struggles, which are sort of in the past now, but the structural issues remain, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. The historical lag in adopting that cutting edge manufacturing technology like EUV lithography is still casting a long shadow. TSMC, through its pure play foundry model and massive scale, was simply quicker and more adept at scaling up these critical, incredibly complex technologies. EUV, extreme ultraviolet lithography, is essential for drawing the microscopic circuits on the most advanced chips. Today we're talking 5 nanometer, 3 nanometer, and beyond. Now, Intel is investing heavily, massively in EUV now. They're buying the machines from ASML, just like TSMC and Samsung, but they are fundamentally playing catch-up in terms of integrating it effectively and achieving high yields at scale across their manufacturing network.
And that lag, that catch-up phase, translates directly into tangible financial consequences, right? Higher manufacturing costs, potentially lower yields initially, maybe slower product rollouts compared to the foundries Apple currently relies on, like TSMC.
Precisely. Higher costs, lower margins, execution risk. And this leads us directly to the inherent risk embedded in CEO Pat Gelsinger's ambitious turnaround strategy, IDM 2.0. This strategy requires staggering multi-billion dollar investments year after year just to try and regain manufacturing parity with TSMC and Samsung. And on top of that, they're trying to build a successful large-scale foundry business, IFS, essentially from scratch, to compete directly with TSMC for customers like, well, potentially Apple someday, but also Qualcomm, NVIDIA, etc. This is a high-stakes, highly uncertain, long-term operational pivot. It's a massive gamble, frankly. Apple, conversely, is a company that overwhelmingly prefers low-risk, high-probability returns on its capital. Predictability is key. Investing significant capital into Intel's IDM 2.0 turnaround. That is almost the dictionary definition of a high-risk gamble from Apple's perspective.
And we need to keep connecting this back to the origin story of the Apple Silicon transition.
Yeah.
It's so fundamental. The very reason Apple ditched Intel for its Macs was precisely to achieve those performance and efficiency gains that Intel's own roadmap at that specific time simply could not provide reliably. So Intel's current path, desperately trying to rebuild its manufacturing prowess, is still fraught with the exact kind of execution risk and roadmap volatility that Apple deliberately sought to eliminate from its own supply chain by taking control.
The performance divergence we've seen since the M1 chip launched is the clearest illustration of this fundamental difference in paths. Apple's M series chips have created this incredible performance and efficiency halo around the entire Mac lineup.
They redefine the category in many ways. Meanwhile, Intel's traditional CPU offerings, while still powerful, are locked in these daily brutal market share battles against AMD and even ARM-based competitors in some segments. Investing in a company that is still trying to overcome its core operational weaknesses, weaknesses that directly impacted Apple negatively in the past, it just seems fundamentally antithetical to Apple's financial doctrine and strategic logic.
Okay, so if the answer to the Intel investment question is, based on all this analysis, a pretty firm no, or at least highly improbable, then we absolutely need to dedicate sufficient time to the flip side. Where does Apple actually put its money? We know they generate enormous amounts of cash. How does a company with Apple's truly immense financial resources, hundreds of billions in cash and marketable securities, deploy that capital most effectively? How do they satisfy investors, maintain growth, and secure their future?
Right, and this is where Apple's proven capital allocation strategy really shines, and it truly is a masterclass, particularly for a mature tech company, in generating predictable, high-probability financial returns. And it stands in such stark contrast to the speculative nature of the Intel rumor. Apple generally focuses its capital deployment into four main interconnected priorities. These have been consistent for years now.
Okay, let's break those down. Let's start with the biggest bucket, financially speaking, and perhaps the one that sometimes attracts controversy, share buybacks.
Share buybacks are, without a doubt, Apple's single most significant use of capital and arguably its most effective strategy for capital deployment as a mature, highly profitable, cash-rich company. Apple runs one of the largest, if not the largest, share repurchase programs in corporate history. We're talking authorizing tens, sometimes close to $100 billion per year. The mechanism itself is simple, but the impact is powerful. The company uses its cash reserve to buy back its own stock from the open market. This reduces the total number of outstanding shares available to the public.
And why is reducing the share count so crucial for shareholder value? What's the magic there?
Well, it directly juices a key metric, earnings per share, or EPS. It's simple math. When the company's total net income, its profit, is divided by a smaller number of outstanding shares, the resulting EPS figure automatically increases, even if total profit stays the same. And investors, Wall Street analysts, they heavily scrutinize EPS growth as a primary measure of corporate profitability and health. So constantly boosting that EPS figure, even when your revenue growth might be maturing, is absolutely key to maintaining a high stock valuation and keeping investors happy. It also signals strong management confidence in the company's future prospects. They believe the stock is undervalued. And buybacks are often favored over, say, massive dividend increases at the stage of Apple's life cycle because they offer a more tax-efficient way for many investors to realize capital gains while also strategically manipulating those key valuation metrics like EPS. It's a very efficient, reliable financial lever for them.
Okay, so buybacks are the primary direct return mechanism to shareholders. The second priority you mentioned, research and development, R&D, that's where they invest to secure their future dominance.
Precisely. If buybacks are about returning value today, R&D is about creating value tomorrow. The investment here is absolutely relentless, and it's strategically designed to build and maintain their competitive moat. It's defensive and offensive. We're talking massive, sustained funding into R&D for areas like artificial intelligence and machine learning. This is foundational now to almost everything they do, from Siri to computational photography to optimizing battery life. Then there's the huge capital commitment to augmented and virtual reality, which is, you know, most visibly exemplified by the recent launch of the Vision Pro headset. That's a long-term bet requiring deep R&D. And crucially, tying back to our main topic, they invest heavily in future custom silicon advancements, exploring next-generation process nodes with TSMC, designing novel chip architectures years ahead of product launches, improving their GPUs, the neural engine.
So that significant R&D spend on silicon ensures they maintain or even widen the performance and efficiency gap they created when they moved away from Intel in the first place.
It is the ultimate insurance policy against ever being dependent again. Yes, they are investing billions internally to guarantee, as much as possible, that they are never again hostage to an external entity's lagging roadmap or manufacturing problems. This R&D bucket also includes developing advanced health sensor technology for the Apple Watch and future devices, exploring novel battery chemistries for longer life and faster charging, all sorts of things. This capital deployment directly extends their competitive edge, creates new product categories, and ultimately drives future profitability potential.
Right. And the third priority seems to cover their operational backbone and also feeds into that massive growth engine you mentioned earlier, the services division.
Exactly. That falls under the umbrella of strategic growth initiatives and general CapEx or capital expenditures.
These are investments in the doing part of the business. Apple absolutely must continually invest in its booming services division. Think the App Store, iCloud Storage, Apple Music, Apple TV, plus Fitness, plus all those subscriptions. This services segment represents a rapidly growing share of their total revenue, and critically, it's the highest margin component of their entire business. It's incredibly profitable. Maintaining that growth trajectory requires immense annual capex just to build, maintain, and run the massive global data center infrastructure needed to support billions of users and devices. It's a huge operational lift. Furthermore, they need ongoing capital investment to maintain and expand their global retail store presence, manage incredibly complex global logistics and supply chains, and continually enhance their manufacturing capabilities and processes, even if they outsource the final chip fabrication.
So these investments, you know, they might seem less glamorous than launching a new iPhone or the Vision Pro, but they're absolutely essential infrastructure. They support the predictable recurring revenue streams from services and ensure the smooth operation of the entire Apple ecosystem.
Absolutely essential. They are predictable, necessary expenses that yield pretty much guaranteed operational returns simply by maintaining the functionality and reach of the ecosystem. Now, contrast that kind of guaranteed operational return from building data centers with the highly speculative, highly volatile potential return from investing billions in Intel's IDM 2.0 turnaround strategy. From a CFO's perspective, the choice is blindingly clear. You invest where the return is predictable and supports your core model.
Okay, makes sense. Finally, the fourth bucket. They reserve some capital for smaller, more tactical strategic maneuvers and also for direct returns via dividends.
That's right. The fourth bucket covers strategic acquisitions and dividends. As we touched on, acquisitions for Apple are generally very targeted. They focus on acquiring smaller, innovative firms, often for the talent, acquihires, or for a specific piece of technology or intellectual property. Usually, these deals are well under $1 billion, sometimes much smaller. These are strategic integrations designed to quickly plug specific skill gaps or IP holes within Apple's existing product roadmap. They are not about propping up a former industry giant or making large financial bets. And then alongside these targeted acquisitions, Apple does provide consistent, steadily growing, if relatively modest compared to buybacks, dividends. That provides another avenue for efficiently returning capital directly to shareholders, particularly those who prefer regular income.
So when you put it all together, you have this really multifaceted, incredibly disciplined, almost machine-like approach to capital allocation. It's focused obsessively on internal growth, on controlling their own destiny with custom silicon, and on efficiently boosting shareholder returns, primarily through massive buybacks. And that whole picture stands in such direct, powerful contrast to the speculative nature, the diversification risk, the inherent operational risks associated with investing heavily in a struggling legacy semiconductor manufacturer like Intel. The difference isn't just strategic, is it? It feels almost philosophical.
It really is. You could frame it as the difference between operating a meticulously engineered, finely tuned machine designed for predictable, compounding growth within its defined ecosystem, and backing a high-stakes, uncertain, incredibly expensive operational overhaul of a completely different machine with a complex past. For the typical financial analyst looking at Apple, the rumored Intel investment is likely dismissed almost immediately on those grounds alone. It just doesn't fit the pattern or the established priorities.
Okay, so we've journeyed through the history, we've dissected the depth of the strategic mismatch between the two companies now, and we've detailed the rigidity of Apple's financial prudence and where their money actually goes. Let's try and bring it all home now. Let's synthesize the final analysis for everyone listening.
Yeah, the final analysis, based on everything we've discussed, seems unequivocally clear. This rumored overture from Intel to Apple, if it happened, appears to be a fundamentally mismatched proposition, strategically and financially. The consensus among serious financial analysts looking at Apple's track record and stated goals would almost inevitably reinforce that Apple's capital, its hundreds of billions, is best deployed within its own highly successful, tightly controlled operational framework and directed towards its established priorities of share buybacks, internal R&D, supporting its services growth, and maybe small targeted acquisitions, not large external investments and turnarounds.
And if we just review those shifting power dynamics one last time, it really crystallizes the situation. Intel's motivation for potentially seeking such an investment seems clear, almost logical from their perspective. It's defensive. It's strategic. They need capital for the IDM 2.0 build-out. They likely need anchor partners for their nascent foundry business, IFS, and they desperately need to overcome the massive technical and manufacturing hurdles they face. An Apple investment could, in theory, help with all of that.
Absolutely. Intel's motivation makes sense in the context of their own fight for survival and relevance. But for Apple, the move would represent a significant, almost inexplicable deviation from the core strengths and strategies they have spent the last decade and billions upon billions of dollars carefully cultivating. They painstakingly built this vertically integrated ecosystem where they control the silicon design, the operating system, the key software, and the end-user experience to an extent that very few other major tech companies can even approach. Injecting significant capital into Intel simply serves none of those core strategic goals for Apple. It doesn't enhance their ecosystem control. Arguably, it dilutes focus. Their focus remains, laser-like, on maintaining and extending that total control over their platform, not diversifying into the complex, messy, and challenging turnaround landscape of a legacy competitor they successfully managed to abandon years ago.
So, stepping back from just Apple and Intel, what does this whole situation, this rumor and the underlying dynamics, what does this all mean for the broader semiconductor industry?
Well, I think it highlights a couple of key things. For Intel specifically, its future really hinges entirely on the success or failure of Pat Gelsinger's IDM 2.0 turnaround. There's not really a plan B visible. Success means overcoming those manufacturing hurdles, regaining a competitive edge in both chip design and production, and crucially, building a viable, trusted foundry service, IFS, that can attract major customers. It's a monumental task. Apple, meanwhile, seems firmly poised to continue its current trajectory, leveraging its custom silicon expertise to push the boundaries across its product lines, Macs, iPhones, iPads, wearables, and into new areas like AI, spatial computing with Vision Pro, maybe even automotive eventually. Their paths are clearly diverging, not converging. This rumor, whether it had any basis in fact or not, simply served to starkly highlight just how far apart those paths have become since Apple Silicon debuted.
It really does hammer home that the strategic decision Apple made all those years ago to invest in designing its own chips and move away from x86 for the Mac wasn't just about getting a temporary performance upgrade. It was a fundamental, long-term economic and strategic choice about controlling their own destiny.
It absolutely was. And maybe here's a final provocative thought for you, the listener, to mull over as we conclude this deep dive. The mere potential for Intel, a foundational American tech company, to even theoretically approach Apple for investment, it really highlights the increasing fragility of the traditional integrated device manufacturing model in the face of pure-play foundry dominance. It also underscores the absolutely critical strategic importance of proprietary chip design and access to leading-edge manufacturing in the modern global tech economy. Silicon is everything now. Now, watch Apple's capital allocation strategy today is rigidly focused on maximizing shareholder returns through those buybacks and funding its own internal R&D. You have to consider its sheer scale. Its massive cash reserve, unprecedented in corporate history, really, grants it unique leverage and power. If a company like Intel, crucial to the U.S. domestic semiconductor supply chain, were to seriously falter or fail, could that pose broader systemic risks? Does Apple's immense financial might, accumulated through its ecosystem success, also grant it some kind of implicit duty, or at least a strategic imperative, to potentially intervene or help stabilize parts of the broader tech ecosystem, particularly domestically, even if the direct financial return isn't immediately clear or compelling? Think about how a single company's tightly focused financial strategy dictates not just its own phenomenal success, but potentially, indirectly, the fate of its former partners and perhaps even the stability of critical industrial supply chains. It's a complex question with no easy answers.
That geopolitical and industrial security angle definitely takes this rumor far beyond simple stock market speculation or corporate strategy analysis. It forces us, as you say, to ask whether the relentless pursuit of maximum corporate efficiency and ecosystem control, often achieved through strategic separation and vertical integration, might come with broader, perhaps unforeseen, costs or responsibilities related to overall industrial stability, especially in strategic sectors like semiconductors. Definitely something to consider as both of these tech titans continue to execute their respective and indeed very different strategies moving forward.